You are listening to How We Got Loud. I'm your host, Chris Leonard, and I want all of us to go on a journey together exploring stories about the people, technology, and passion that built the history of live sound. Today, I'm talking with David Morgan, currently the front of house engineer for James Taylor, Stevie Nicks, and Fleetwood Mac.
I would hope that people would remember me as someone who made millions of people happy. I really love looking at the faces of people as they're walking out of a show. Once again, that's instantaneous feedback. You don't want to have the people scowling outnumber the people smiling. Luckily, it's been pretty consistent with people walking out with big smiles on their face, and that means so much to me, you know, that I was able to be a clear enough window between them and the artist that they came to admire and to express their love for. I've been lucky to work for several artists who've allowed me to exercise the control that I can exert over a show to manipulate people's emotions. There are so many things you can do with a mix that will lead people in the direction that you want them to take. To see that be successful and have people walk out of a show with joy radiating from them is the best feedback I can get. It's all part of the love.
David is one of the humblest people I have met, with a resume that's multiple pages deep, with artists like Paul Simon, Whitney Houston, Steely Dan, the Doobie Brothers, and the list goes on. He has also been nominated multiple times and won a Parnelli Award and the Tech Foundation Award. Make sure you check out howwegotloud.com to see some of the pictures David has sent me, as well as other episodes. While you're at it, please tell a friend about this podcast and subscribe on your favorite podcast player. So, David, after 40-some years of doing this business, why do you still do it?
Because I love it. There's nothing like it. I mean, I live on the rush from live shows. That's what's kept me in it. That's what keeps me getting up the next day. That keeps me improving the quality of mixes. That, you know, it keeps me learning new things. It's all about the love.
Well, then what got you there to begin with?
The same thing, because I was a musician. I started out playing professionally, you know, modestly at 14 years old when I got paid $25 to play at a junior high school dance. And I've really never done anything since. Any other jobs I had in would be just to pay for I need a job. I'd get a new guitar, you know? So I'd go and deliver furniture or something like that, you know, but it wasn't working. It was paying for a new guitar. And so it was the same thing then. It's the same thing now, you know, even when I'm not on the road, you know, I'm kept from doing what I really love, but I have a guitar here in the house and I still sing. So, I mean, it's the same thing, you know. The best way for me to keep my chops together as a mixer is to play and sing a lot. So music is running through my body all the time.
So what was the first time that you did something sound related as opposed to, you know, musician side of things?
Well, I was that guy in the band who owned the PA and owned the van and, you know, own the microphones and half the band's instruments. You know, I'd go from band to band and collecting instruments. And, you know, by the at one point I had a beautiful 73 Rhodes, a suitcase. I had a Farfisa organ when we had the reggae band back in Boston, when we had Jamaica Hilton back in Boston. I had a whole bunch of guitars, and you know, I just
would acquire more stuff. And, you know, if we wanted to play gigs with the people I was playing with, we had to have a PA, and I guess I was the one who bought it. So it, you know, this is how it's always been.
What was that first console you bought?
The first one that actually worked was a custom tuck and roll, six channel, 100 watt, mono, you know, club mixer. So we could put six microphones into it, because we had six guys who sang in the reggae band.
Nice. And so everything else was just naturally amplified from stage sound, right? It was just really,
yeah, getting, we just put them
over the,
yeah,
top.
Yeah, we were doing clubs all over New England and even down as far as New York. And so it was, I had two Trainer PA cabinets. So they were two 15s, but one was a coax. And that was it. They were actually pretty good sounding boxes. And they were 16 ohm boxes, as I remember. And, you know, we just run them out in parallel and get as much as we could out of the amplifier, you know? So it was fun days back then. This is, you know, this is early 70s in a bands that I played in that were based in the New England area. And we went from a Volkswagen bus to a Dodge Tradesman. we ended up having a real vehicle. So, you know, it was fun. We were doing okay. But it was, there's nothing about what I'm doing now that's any different from what I was doing then. I would wake up and live music every day. That was basically it once I got out of college.
That's awesome. So, and then how did you figure out from a, were you kind of a tech head in terms of like, did you know wiring and stuff like that? Or did you, you know, trial by fire in terms of, oh, that didn't work? Or what was that experience like kind of getting some of the technology going gear wise?
No, I knew nothing. I learned how to solder my own cables and things like that from the hard way, you know, trial and error, you know, going out and buying the wrong solder, you know, why don't I have any audio coming through here? You have to get rosin core solder. Who knew? So, you know, the mistakes one makes when one ventures out alone, you know, of course I'd ask everybody, you know, and, I kind of force fed myself, audio and electronics and even a little electricity along the way.
So when you were traveling, you know, with those bands and stuff, what was in your mind in terms of knowing, was this an industry you were pursuing, or you were just along for the ride at that moment and just the next moment kept coming and coming beyond after that?
As far as mixing goes?
Yeah.
I tried working in studios. That didn't work out very well. I don't have the right kind of personality or temperament for working in a studio. You really need patience and a quiet demeanor to be a second engineer and a, you know, staff engineer at a studio. Mm-hmm. I was a little too bombastic. You know, I was a guy who thought he was a rock star who never really made it. But, you know, I might have come with a little attitude in my 20s. I don't know. Maybe. But I know I didn't belong in studios. And I finished one project and by basically assassinating myself at the studio that I was working at. I had a strong disagreement with the producer and the artist about how long it was taking us to record a certain thing. And at that point, I walked out of the front door and never came back because I knew I was fired. I was done. you can't yell at the producer. But boy, I was so sick of hearing that solo played badly. You know, as a guitar player, it was just killing me. It was absolutely killing me. And finally, I snapped. 2 weeks on one solo, you know. Solid. 8 hours a day.
And so then what was that? What was that next progression like after the studio? What was in your head? Where were you headed?
Well, while I was working in studios, because back then you didn't get paid anything. I had to have a moonlighting job as well. And my moonlighting job was at this very famous country and Western nightclub in North Hollywood, California, called the Palomino. And if you look back in the history of venues here in LA, as far as the West Coast goes, it was one of the premier country venues. And I was mixing out there 3 to 4 nights a week to make an extra $50 a night, you know? And that was my introduction to actual dedicating more time to live sound than either guitar playing or studio engineering. And I loved it. I had the greatest time. And it was like a movie. It was any old country and Western movie you've seen where the guy who's mixing it with his right hand and holding a spotlight with his left hand. That was me. There were nights when I had to do the spots if I couldn't talk one of the waitresses into holding it. You know? or if I didn't have a buddy there or you know. And so it was, you could lock it on, but mm-hmm. if you had more than, two people, or more than one person doing all the talking, if it was alternating back and forth, you could either widen out the spot and you'd lose it, or you had to move it. And so, if it had to be moved, it had to be moved, and it was right there next to me. So they assumed that it was mine as well. And I became very intimate with that spotlight. And it was a great experience. And it was the experience that got me hired at a major sound company. So I will always cherish the time that I spent at the Palomino.
What kind of gear was at the Palomino at that time, like console and speaker wise? Was it, is it homemade stuff or was it still, is it actual off the shelf stuff?
It was a brand new 24 channel Yamaha PM1000. It was excellent.
And I mean, it had to have been like the most pristine console you'd been on at that point, right?
We hung JBL 2420s. I think it's a speaker. It would be a 22. 24 would be a high frequency driver. I'm trying to remember the name of the cabinet. It was a standard studio three-way monitor. And we hung up. I'll try to remember the model number if I can, but this is a long time ago. And we hung individual cabinets from various spots on the ceiling and, put them up as a permanent installation. And I worked with a buddy named Dave Hopkinson back then, and he had a little mom and pop sound company called Zeta Sound Systems, and they did the install. And I don't remember how I was introduced to the guy. I remember we had taken a class together, and anyway, he and I ended up working together. We attended a class in the mid 70s at some point together. And so I've reconnected with him, and he helped, he had me help him install the JBL monitors in the ceiling. And then I had never seen anything as elaborate as a PM1000. I was in heaven. It was great. We had like two compressors or something and maybe a reverb.
And at that time, were you in the back of your mind still saying, hey, I got to find a way to make the guitar thing happen? Or were you?
Yes. Oh, yeah. That didn't go away until I actually went out on tour with a really good band. And I said to myself, I'm never going to be this good. And I belong here where I am. I bumbled around doing monitors a bit when I finally got hired to a big sound company. And as I found out that I wasn't suited personality-wise to being in a studio, I found I was even less suited intellectually to being a monitor engineer, because my attention span is zero, which for a front of house engineer is fantastic. For a monitor engineer, it's death. You know, I like the fact that in doing my job, I can allow myself to be blown away by the music. Because if I'm having a good time, I'm pretty sure everybody else is too, you know, because I'm my own worst critic. And so if I'm rocking out, 99% of the time I'm looking around me and everybody else is rocking out too. And so that's one of the great and wonderful things about our job is the instantaneous feedback. You know, there's no delay. You know what's happening immediately. And I love that.
So fast forward, like you said, you got your first gig at a sound company. Where was that?
A1 Audio.
Ah.
A company that did mostly Las Vegas acts.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was probably in 1978, because I first went to work for them when they were on the Columbia Pictures lot in Hollywood. And then we moved over to the old TFA building, which became Electrotech when they moved out to out here to Thousand Oaks, where I live. And we moved into that. I remember doing the big move into that building, and I was often a weekend warrior up in Vegas. You know, you drive the 26-foot truck up there and do a show with Wayne Newton or Shirley MacLaine or Charo or, you know, or the Tops and the Temps, you know. Mm-hmm. It was whatever was working in Vegas at the time. But all these mainline artists, you know, Tony Orlando and Don, So I latched on to Suzanne Summers, and I was doing front of house for her, the girl from Three's Company. And I did okay. And God knows I really didn't know an awful lot about what I was doing, but what was coming out of the PA sounded good. So I don't know. Didn't know really why it sounded good at the time, but I was willing to learn. And I ended up mixing front of house for a guy from Sacramento who was managed by the Doobie Brothers manager, Bruce Cohn. And he took notice of me, and he came to several of the shows done by this artist, a guy named Roger Vidouris. And his brother Steve is a very well-known tour manager still. And both guys were great. And I believe Roger has passed, sadly. But that got me onto the Doobie Brothers crew. Now, I didn't go out mixing the Doobie Brothers. I went out pushing PA and pulling four-aught, you know. And that was in about midway through 1978. And then by 1979, I was the crew chief, and in 79, I got my first opportunity to mix the band.
And so, were you guys using the VIP speakers at the time?
Yeah, we were.
Were you so flying at the time, or was it still?
Oh, yeah, we were. We were stacking them too, at all the sheds and stuff. Oh my God, it was comical. It was Gauss 15s in the RCA bins, right? And in the top, there were two 2390 horns, you know, 90 degree radials with 2482s on them, right? You know, foghorns drivers, and, you know, old phenolics. And there were eight 2402 bullets, high frequency drivers that were passed over across of crossed over passively, and inside the series parallel network that we had to wire on those 8 tweeters to get it down to like 4 ohms or something, so the poor BGW amplifiers wouldn't blow them all up. That was a work of art, and that taught me a lot. The other thing that I learned at A1 was how to solder, how to build snakes, how to build all sorts of stuff. We had a really active wood shop. The carpenter was a guy named Lou Manick, and he was a practical genius. The guy could build anything, and so he and I, after the 79 Doobie Brothers tour, which was going to be the last for the guy who was the front of house engineer, Gray Ingram, at least the head engineer, because as I said, there were times that I would mix the band and Bob Hodes was mixing drums, who went on to become a fixture up at the record plant up in Sausalito. And he teaches, he was a wonderful engineer and a great guy to be on tour with. And, I don't have enough great things to say about my time with the Doobie Brothers. They gave me my big shot, and they had faith in me, and I couldn't have asked for a nicer boss than Pat Simmons for my work, the first big band that I worked for.
So what was that experience like? You're kind of in an industry you weren't necessarily vying to get to. Your focus, your past, your focus now with guitar. You're now mixing on, at an A level, if you will, at those times. Did that hit you at the time at all, or was that a past reflection? Or were you mostly living in the moment at the time and just doing the gig?
I was trying to cram so much experience into me in that period that I don't think I really stopped to consider how meteoric that particular evolution happened. Here I was, figuring some way to keep myself alive while I tried to write better songs. And then all of a sudden this door opened. And who'd have thought that the keeper of the gate would have been Albert Siniscal? And he was a wonderful character, and I hope you get a chance to interview him. Al was a brilliant man, but the VIPs were a pretty quirky design, and it was we had a lot of fun at A1. Me and the chief engineer was a guy named Bobby Ross, and I talked him into somehow redesigning a whole lot of stuff. We redesigned the wedges. We redesigned the flying system for the VIPs and made it more efficient, so you could actually get some downward tilt out of the darn things. It was a great experience, but it was crammed into such a short period. It was like it was only at A1. For like a little over 2 years, and all this stuff happened, and in the meantime I'm trying to learn acoustical physics, I'm trying to learn electronics design, I'm trying to learn what a 1032 screw looks like, all these things are just getting crammed into me. So no, I really didn't, I didn't stop to consider it in those first couple of years. And then when we went to go back on the road in 1980, I was thinking I would go back out as the front of house guy on the Doobie Brothers. And I get this offer from one of the hugest stars at the time, will you come out and mix my tour? Well, it turned out to be Kenny Newman's gig. It turned out to be Barry Manilow. And, I called up Bruce Cohn and I said, I got this offer and here's the dollars he's offering me. And at the time, Bruce was only going to pay me half of what Barry was offering me. And I said, can we meet halfway? And Bruce said, no, I don't want to do that, I think. And so it ended up being really a huge moment for me to decide to not pursue my relationship with the Doobie Brothers and go for what could be a career maker. I mean, at the time, the Doobies were one of the biggest bands in the world. You know, that's, mm-hmm. there's no denying that they were, it was a fantastic opportunity just to stay with them. They ended up fine. They ended up hiring Shep Lonsdale, who had been with them before, and it was a great idea. And I went and I did the Barry Manilow thing. But once again, you find out, do you belong here or do you belong there? At the end of about 150 some shows, I realized that I didn't belong there. It wasn't long after that that Kenny Newman got the job, and I'm really glad he did, because he's done an amazing job for Barry, and it's been very good for him. And somehow, the phone rang one day, right after the Barry Manilow tour had ended in 1980, and it was Jim Gamble. And I didn't really know Jim. I had only worked for one sound company. I'd never worked for Tycho Brahe, but I certainly know who Jim Gamble was. And he asked me to go down and take a look at what was going on in what was at the time called Innovative Audio. Innovative Audio had purchased the assets of Tycho Brahe when Bob Bogdanovich decided he wanted to sell the sound company. And he sold it to a former employee and his wife. And Jim wanted me to go down and give him some, you know, make some observations and pass them on to him. He said, you know, get on there for a couple of weeks at the most. I ended up staying there for over 5 years. I ended up being general manager of Innovative Audio. And then when Innovative was sold to Dirk Schubert and his dad, we all became Schubert Systems Group. And that was another meteoric thing. You know, I'm down there 2 years and all of a sudden now I'm partners in what is a fairly major sound company. We had excellent clients back then. We had Willie Nelson and Waylon Jennings. We had the Starship. We had the Doobie Brothers. We had it was a fun company. And all the designs were done by Jim Gamble and Dirk Schubert, just like in the heyday of Tycho Brahe. And it was kind of breathing new life back into the old company and keeping the tradition going. And so, as you can see, I've had a lot of situations where I've been in the right place at the right time. And believe me, I know how lucky I've been. Some people spend a lifetime and never get the kind of breaks that had been offered to me. And so I spent a little over 5 years down there. And I got a little weary of not being on the road as much as I wanted to be, because like I said, I live for the shows, and I was stuck behind a desk for almost all of my time. And stuck on a telephone. When I'd go to gigs, I wouldn't go to mix them. I'd go as the sound company owner, you know, and general manager of the company. So it got tiresome, and so eventually we all parted ways. It was one of those, what am I going to do now moments. And I tried doing various consulting work for, I signed up briefly as a consultant with my friend Bob Stern called me and said, you know, Northwest Sound was just sold to Maryland Sound, and they want somebody on the West Coast. Are you interested in doing it? I said, well, I'm interested in doing it as a consultant. And so that, there was a brief relationship there, and but you know, I really wanted to get back to mixing. And once again, here I am in the right place at the right time. Something had happened on Whitney Houston that required them, the front of house guy had to go home. And I got called. I said, do you want to do Whitney Houston? I said, absolutely. And this was in 1986 on her first solo tour. And you know, at the time, I don't think there was anything bigger in the world than Whitney Houston. And I just walked right into it and had an absolute ball. I mean, getting the opportunity of hearing that woman singing every night was such a wonderful gift. I mean, to be a recipient of her amazing gift, and to hear it every night. I mean, I've never heard anybody sing like that, never in my life, and I never will again. I mean, she was one of in a billion. So it was a great opportunity for me, and it just happened that at a show that we did at Wembley Arena that. Someone very important in my life was at that show, and I got a call after the Whitney show in Wembley from Paul Simon's manager, and he said, if anyone who can make Wembley Arena sound like that, we want mixing Paul Simon. Will you please do the Graceland tour? And you couldn't knock me down with a feather, because you know, I mean, this is Paul Simon, you know? Yeah. And I said I kind of said to myself, you know, at the time, you know, who else could I possibly work for who wasn't a Beatle that would be better than Paul Simon? And I thought to myself, Riley, well, maybe James Taylor. Right. So, that was the beginning of a 21 year association with Paul Simon. And I don't have to talk much about that. That was the best thing that could ever happen to a live sound engineer. You know, I mean, starting by mixing the Graceland shows.
Yeah.
I mean, crazy. God almighty.
It's crazy.
You know, if there was ever a better show on the road, it was Paul Simon in the 1991 tour, when we did the Born at the Right Time tour with the Brazilian musicians and Michael Brecker was in the band, and Richard T was in the band, and Steve Gadd was in the band, and Chris Bode was in the band, and the Waters were singing, and oh my God, it was just the most amazing thing every night. And we did 162 shows in 36 countries with that tour. It was pretty, that was the best yes I ever said, was to say yes to Paul Simon to go mix that tour.
So what was your path up to this point? I don't want to say fake it till you make it, but you're learning as you go, and you're trying to figure things out. At this time, though, how were you learning and perfecting your craft? Like, how were you, you know, obviously virtual sound check wasn't a thing, and you're going from tour to tour. You were in the office for a bit. How did you find time to progress other than just the show itself?
I had wonderful mentors, starting with Gray Ingram on the Doobie Brothers. I mean, he taught me basically everything I know about how to mix a live show. I learned on the very first tour, I was out watching Gray, because I'd ask questions. And I really paid attention, and I started doing cues for him. You know, if we had to change delay times and something, if we had to, you know, punch a certain button at a certain time, I would do it for him. You know, so all he had to do was keep his hands on the faders. And he was so impressed by that, that he decided to teach me everything he knew. And what a gift that was. So at the time, Gray Ingram was, you know, he ended up, after the 79 tour, after the Minute by Minute tour, Gray went to work for SSL as the primary North American installer of their consoles. Gray was a brilliant man.
And then, you know, how much of your journey through this time and through gear wise, you know, console wise and you know, as outboard grew, how much of that were you picking and choosing? How much of it was just decided by the sound company? What type of stuff was available? So maybe like specifically like Whitney Houston and Paul Simon, what consoles and kind of outboard gear would you be using around that time?
Whitney, I was doing on a Harrison Alive. And I inherited that from the previous front of house engineer, a wonderful man named Al Tucker, God rest his soul, who just passed away. And Al was in love with this particular machine, and I had seen it because I had done a brief tour as the systems engineer with the Little River Band. And Ernie Rose and Michael, the monitor engineer, were mixing on Harrison Alives. And this was the first time any of us ever saw VCAs on a live mixing console. And so I did Whitney on two Harrison Alives, and I did Graceland on the same rig. But as far as learning new gear goes, I was a real student. When I was off the road, I was in the shop listening to gear programming. You know, the old Black 224 came out back then, you know, and that was a watershed. And to, you know, to have a digital reverb that actually worked and you could make useful sounds out of. And you know, delays were just becoming cheaper because, you know, an old Eventide delay was extremely expensive. It was $5,000 or $6,000 back in, you know, late '70s money, you know, and the Harmon, a 910 was expensive as well. And we had a couple of those on the Doobie Brothers. We had, the Eventide, the three banger delay, we had 1176s on all the vocals, so I learned how to work those by playing with them but I had to use a wax marker to make sure that I put the knobs back right where they were, otherwise Gray would have killed me. But you know, before everybody got out there, I'd have headphones on and I'd be listening. But and we had the luxury of mixing on these two custom 24 channel APIs that have been cut down from the studio versions to be live consoles. And oh my God, these things sounded good. So I went from my very first exposure to big time touring, I got used to great sounding gear, you know? So, we just went on from there. A1 had a nice stock of really good gear. So whenever I was putting a tour together, it was always my choice of gear.
And just because we're in that time frame of Paul Simon, Whitney Houston, what PA wise, what was of it? Was that A1? Is that the time when the VIP? I imagine you progressed beyond.
No, this was Maryland Sound.
Oh, okay.
And we used Hypax and Lopax, was their TAD boxes.
Yeah.
And with the Northwest 90 degree radial horn on it, the horn that everyone loved for years and years and years. So that was, we did Graceland on the actual sound company for Graceland was Britannia Row, because we started out in England. And the tour was actually based in London. I spent more time in London than I spent in the United States in 1987. So the Brian Grant and Britannia Row were our first sound company, and Brian had a deal with a reciprocal deal with Maryland Sound in the States. So we had Maryland Sound gear available to us through Britannia Row in Europe. And then when we were in the States, Maryland Sound became the contractor.
What about system tech wise? Did you have a same system tech from MSI throughout that time, or did it kind of rotate?
We started out with a guy named Dick Weber was the system tech, and he was from Britrail. And Dick stayed with us the whole time. He was always my guy at front of house. And we started out with a monitor engineer named Jerry Fradley over in the States. And when we were doing the shows in Europe at the beginning of Graceland and even the huge show done in Zimbabwe, it was just the three of us. It was a very small crew. It was a lot of work, but it was Graceland. It was you know, if you had to design a perfect show, it might be Graceland.
Yeah.
If you ever get a chance to watch the video from Harare, Zimbabwe that was shot in February of 1987, you'll understand. It was just joy from beginning to end, and the show was a review. It wasn't just Paul, because Paul would do a few songs to start the show, and then Hugh Masekela would do three or four of his songs, and then Paul would do a little bit more, and then Miriam Makeba came out and she did three or four songs, and then she and Paul sang African Skies together as a duet, as they did on the album. After that, Ladysmith Black Mambazo would come out and they'd do three songs by themselves. And then Paul would come out to join them for the song Helpless. Oh, talk about one of the most amazing moments in the show. I mean, just everything breaking down to 10 guys singing, right? That's it. 10 guys singing. And then Homeless is such a beautiful, beautiful melody. Paul wrote such a beautiful lyric, and Joseph with the, in the Zulu. It's a really special song. And so we did a lot without having a whole lot of technology on that tour. We wanted to up we ended up in 89 when Graceland went back on the road. We ended up having a scheduling problem with trying to get what we needed. And so we ended up having to make a swap, and we swapped, which for Paul was going back to Claire. And this was my first experience with Claire. And I was directed by the tour manager that we were going to go in this direction. And so that became my introduction to Lititz, Pennsylvania. And it's a relationship that's gone on from then until the present.
I find an interesting theme or correlation that it's just one of those things that happens is that, so, you know, you got into this because of intrinsically wanting to be part of delivering entertainment and connecting with the audience and so clued in on the music side. And you were fortunate enough to work with some artists where they are at the supreme of that. I mean, Paul Simon, Steely Dan, they're two of the most iconic musically based artists that there is, that had to have been a pretty cool connection to have gotten there.
I try not to think about how lucky I am so I don't jinx it. But I've been really incredibly fortunate. I guess there must be some talent mixed in there too, but I've been incredibly fortunate. And at one time I was able to juggle tours between Paul Simon, Bette Midler, and Steely Dan for a period of about a dozen years. And what an incredible slice of time that was to go from those three artists whose presentations are completely different, and yet to feel completely at home in with all three of those artists was it was so much fun, you know. Because I don't know if you ever seen a Bette Midler show, but God, she's just hilarious. And it was the last vaudeville show on the road, mm-hmm. and I wanted to be part of that. And she hired me. I guess it was back in '93, and I stayed for 17 years. So it was an incredibly rewarding experience just to be part of that whole thing and to see a woman who certainly wasn't in her 20s any longer be able to sing, dance, and act out her entire show without a single thing being pre-recorded, except like stupid stuff, like a lot of ukuleles on Ukulele Lady or something. You know, if we, we had some gag bits that were on a CD, you know, but the performance was completely live all the time. And Bette and the Harlettes, you know, sang every single note and with incredible precision and doing the dance numbers at the same time. And even to the point where they were wearing mermaid's tails in electric wheelchairs, you know, if it's worth it to watching a Bette Midler show. We recorded shows for HBO in the winter of 1996. And I believe that show won 4 Emmys. It's worth watching. It was a great pleasure to be in the service of Ms. Midler.
So I've seen firsthand what rehearsals or sound check can be like with Paul Simon. For someone who is, I mean, you know, look, he's a genius, right? And he knows what he wants. And he knows where he wants to go. You just better get there with him. Was there ever moments where, you know, you guys had to work things out, or he had to kind of either question or say, hey, I'm not really liking this. I want to go this direction. What was dialogue like with him through the years?
Well, Paul Simon is one of the most creative and gifted people I've ever had the pleasure of sharing space with. And whatever the process it took for him to get from point A to point B and to produce the kind of shows that we were able to produce, everybody was given a lot of leeway to get there. Graceland was this incredible emotional experience, the music was emotional. Rhythm of the Saints became much more cerebral and yet still very, very, physical. But not as so much unbridled joy as it was in Graceland. There was much more control on Rhythm of the Saints. And we got to the point where when we were doing shows in New York City in 1993 with essentially the same band, the perfection that Paul is able to impart to his arrangements is you just have to be in awe. I mean, the guy just draws stuff out of thin air, and you know, somebody can be whistling something while we're, you know, on a coffee break, and Paul will turn that into a rearrangement of one of his songs. You know, it's fun to watch. And as I said, whatever it takes to get the process going and moving to the point where you produce some of the most amazing musical performances that not only I've ever seen, but anyone's ever seen. Those shows we did at the theater at Madison Square Garden, it was called Concert Event of a Lifetime. And the lifetime was Paul Simon's. And it was just astounding in the choice of what he included, the pacing of the show, the rearrangements of the tunes, it was, again, it was a very long show. This one had an intermission. We did like a half hour with Paul and Artie to start the show. And then we went into the, kind of the Ryman Simon era of Paul's earlier solo records, the ones that he did with Phil Ramone. Mm-hmm. And that was like an hour, maybe a little longer. And then we'd take a 20-minute break, and then we'd come back and do Graceland and Rhythm of the Saints, and then we'd finish with Paul and Artie. And it was one of the most beautiful things I've ever been a part of. I can't imagine mixing a band that could possibly play any better than what I heard every night. And we did about 24 shows there the whole month of October in 1993. It was just stunning.
So I want to fast forward a minute. The last tour that you used analog was in 2005 with a PM5K.
Yes, sir. I love that console.
What was the next step? What was that transition for you?
In 2006, I went back to that same setup that I had at that James Taylor show that you had the photo of. I went back to that with Paul in the summer of 2006. In between, James had decided he wanted to do a show in theaters that he called One Man Band, which was just James and Larry Golding's the piano player. And it's a brilliant show. And we were doing it in theaters, and they wanted to maximize selling seats. So the PM5K and the big old racks and all that other stuff became superfluous, excessive in terms of how much real estate we took up in a theater. And plus, you know what it's like working in theaters, you know, mm-hmm. The less you bring in, the better.
The more seats you know.
Yeah, exactly. Well, aside from that, it's hard to, you know, right. you don't want to be putting racks up on plywood up on top of the seats and stuff like that, because terrible things happen when you do that, you know. They either get dropped on the way in or they get dropped on the way out, you know. And through no fault of their own, but, you know, a big old electronics rack weighs a ton, especially one of those older style Clair folding ones, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it was, we started out One Man Band on a 5D, and I did the first leg on that, and I wasn't really getting exactly what I wanted out of it. And so I switched over to a venue profile. And at that point, I became a serious believer in digital mixing. And it wasn't long. I would say I switched off of probably when James did Sheds in the summer of 2007, I was probably on a venue D show. So that when I went away from analog, I went completely away. I went all the way. Mm-hmm. And I started mixing in the box. I didn't bring any racks with me. I had the luxury of having a whole brain trust from DigiDesign come out and help me get acclimated on the console. And we all discovered plugins together, and it was wonderful. And to be able to pioneer a new experience for me, a whole new world of digital mixing, to be able to pioneer that on a show with only two musicians, that was a real godsend. I could really hear what I was doing, as far as, does this plugin do what I think it's going to do? Or, is James's guitar sounding correct and things like that? So, it was a great way to get my feet wet with a show that had about, I think we only had about 20 inputs from the stage. So, and, video inputs, because one man band was kind of like going to watch a slideshow in James Taylor's living room, and he'd show you pictures from the past or stuff, and then tell you stories, and then play a song. And that's another DVD. If you ever get a chance to buy that, because that's some seriously special performing, because James Taylor is very, very funny. And he wrote it himself and produced it himself. And the DVD was incredibly well done. And so it was a one man band was a wonderful experience, because it helped me really get to know James better too. I went to one of the best days of my life was in Sydney with Bette Midler, and of all things. And when I got a call on the radio from our production manager, Chris Adamson, who said, "You need to get in the production office right away. James Taylor's on the telephone." And I laughed, because Chris Adamson is a wind-up artist. One of the best, one of the absolute very best. And so I kind of ignored it. And plus I was on my PM5000, and I was out at front of house, and I had like 8 stagehands out there to lift the behemoth up. And at that very moment in time. And so I kind of ignored the radio call. And then I heard Chris screaming and yelling and waving his hands from one of the corners of the arena, saying, "I'm not joking." And I sprinted for the production office and got on the phone. And at which point James said, "Hello, this is James Taylor." And once again, you could have knocked me over with a feather. And as I said, when I got the job to mix Paul Simon, I said to myself, what could be better than this? James Taylor? So there you go. And I'm 16 years later, and next year will be my 17th when we go back to work. I'm still there. And I couldn't be happier.
So in 2001, you won a tech award from NAMM for the Steely Dan tour, the Y2K tour. What was that award for?
Front of house engineering.
What goes into that? Like what why who kind of nominates you? What would have been the experience of why people would have picked that?
Well, tech awards are, the nominations in tech awards are really the most rewarding thing, because there's a panel of people in our industry who nominate you for the award. And so it's really kind of an award in itself to be nominated. Back then they would have the subscribers and whoever voting for while I worked for high profile artists, I've always pretty much purposely kept my profile very low. I don't do much promotion. I've always worked to support my time off rather than the other way around. Mm. And I really cherish my time at home, and I'm a very private person. And so I was very flattered when I actually won that award for Steely Dan because, you know, I really was surprised how many people noticed my work. I've been fortunate enough to be nominated for that award 11 times. Wow. And Dave Cobb and I, who a wonderful Clara engineer and just a wonderful engineer in general, Dave Cobb and I share that honor of the most nominations for that particular award. It's very, very humbling and gratifying at the same time.
I'm sure. What would you say to, you know, the weekend warrior, the local band mixer, or the, you know, regional sound guy who maybe looks at what it is that you're doing and thinks like, oh my goodness, like that's like the pinnacle or whatnot, like, or, you know, how can I get there? You know, so that I take from what you've said, you come across very humble and very appreciative of everything you've been at. So if I put this, let me try to guess here. My guess would say is that you're not doing anything much more special than anyone else. You just happen to be the right place, right time. But there has to be a little bit more to it than that. What would that conversation be like to someone else?
Oh no, right place in the right time is how you get the job. Talent is how you keep the job, you know, and it not just mixing talent, but, you know, to being able, the interpersonal relations talents, the ability to explain what you're doing in a way that doesn't sound like you're talking down to anybody. You know, the worst thing you can do is go to try to talk to a musician and blind him with science. That's just wrong. It's not going to get you anywhere. Mm-hmm. It's all it's going to do is turn your relationship into an adversarial relationship. You have to learn how to fall on your sword as well. You know, there are times when things go wrong. It doesn't matter if you had anything to do with it. You just take the responsibility and say, hey, it's on me. And you'd be surprised how much good karma that buys you with artists. Because, you know, when I used to be in bands, if I was the leader in the band or the arranger in a band, if somebody made a mistake, if they said, oh, I blew that I never felt any animosity. And the same thing happens in the live event world, you know, take responsibility. Don't assign blame, take responsibility. It shows that, you're not afraid.
Mm-hmm.
And fear is a big thing. You know, a lot of people getting over the fear of, can I do this? It takes a lot of chutzpah to get out there every night. And when the lights go down, it's just you and the PA, you know, you're naked. And I've been extremely blessed to have had, a history of really pretty incredible results. Even when we did a show with Paul for 750,000 people out in Central Park in 1991, the reviews said CD quality sound delivered to 750,000. Dig that one.
Yeah, you take that and run with it for sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's like I said, knowing how to get yourself into the right place makes you available at the right time. Staying in the right place is all on you, and you have to perform, you have to produce results. And, it's a mystery to me sometimes. I just, you know, I'm one of those guys who turns knobs until it sounds good. And it's always been the way, and it was the way it was when I played the guitar. I keep hammering out a sound or hammering on an arrangement until it sounds good. And so I've tried to take those same values and put it into my mixing. And as I said, I've also had wonderful mentors along the way. And it's, but it's up to you whether or not you're going to learn the lessons that are being offered as well. So, I'm just so happy that I managed to spend over 50 years in this fantasy world that we're given permission to play in. And I hope I've made the playground a little bit better place too, you know.
Well, speaking of leaving it a better place, you said you had a lot of mentors along the way. What has it been like for you to give back? Have you actively pursued ways to mentor others? Have people pursued you? What's that relationship been like?
Well, I wrote that column in Front of House magazine for 8 years. I told George I'd do 100 articles, and I did. And I'm really thankful for Terry Lowe to giving me the forum, and for George Peterson for being just the best editor in the world, and for Mark Frank for introducing me to that whole situation there. So when I first started it, I didn't know if anybody was going to be interested, and I did it because I was exploring the Waves platform. And the more I learned about it, the more excited about it I got. And I had spoken with Robert Scoville and with some of the guys up at I guess it, I don't I don't think it it might have become Avid by then, but at DigiDesign, and they wanted me to pursue a relationship with Waves, and Mark Frink made it happen, and so. It was a way to do my own research and yet try to find a new audience for, you know, rather than just people at a warehouse, you know, saying, hey, come over and listen to this. But it's it was a lot of fun, and it evolved into something much, much greater than just doing Waves reviews, you know, to do 100 articles about, you know, why I use what I use and what do I do when I use it, you know. It was a lot of fun. So that was my way of giving back that way. And I would be happy to explore other ways once I'm done with the road. And, you know, I'm 71 now. I don't have a lot more tours left in me. But I used to guest lecture at University of Southern California. My wonderful old friend Ken Lopez was in charge of the production live production department in the School of Music there. And he would have me come in like twice a semester and guest lecture to the kids. And that was a lot of fun. And then I started doing it with John McBride out of Blackbird Academy. And I really enjoy doing that because the kids are so enthusiastic there. And who wouldn't be? You know, you get to learn from all the Claire people and John McBride and the wonderful staff at Blackbird, you know. And they're the most attentive and appreciative kids I've ever had the opportunity to talk in front of. And so, you know, that's what I see myself to continue doing is I really enjoy, you know, appearing in front of a class or a group of people assembled to check out new gear and taking people through it, you know.
What do you think is different about the group of people who came into the industry in your time, so late 70s, early 80s, to say the last decade or so, to the group of people who are coming into our industry now? What's the major difference, if any, that you see in the industry?
Well, it's the difference between A and D, isn't it? People of my age had the opportunity to hear all the wonderful analog gear that you have plugins for now, you know? And so, you know, I know what an LA-2 is supposed to sound like, you know? I know what a Fairchild is supposed to sound like. And so when I'm comparing and choosing plugins, I'm comparing them to real analog gear in my mind, because the memories are never going to disappear. And that's the one thing that I wish people coming up now had, because not only are you able to do a better one-for-one substitution, you're also better able to cut down the size of the search area, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you choose a plugin now if you're not trying to relate it to a piece of classic analog gear? I don't know. I mean, there's thousands and thousands and thousands of plugins now. how do you know? I mean, doesn't Waves have like 3 million now or something? You know, I mean, it just seems that there's such a proliferation of software that to acquire a working understanding of all of them is, of course, impossible. So you're only going to get to know a few. If you're going to focus on a few, I've found that it's easier for me to focus on something that relates to a piece of gear that I know what it sounded like in its original version. You know, I know what all analog studio consoles sound like. So if I'm listening to a master strip that says it's going to be an SSL and it's a piece of trash, I can tell you immediately if it's a piece of trash because it doesn't sound like an SSL. Mm-hmm. But I can also tell you if something is a really good emulation. And I'm open to new stuff. I mean, there are plugins based in non-reality for as far as a digital world, an analog world goes. It, you know, something like a Waves Vitamin plugin. You know, that's become part of my tool belt all the time, and it's just managing harmonics. And who'd have thunk it? You know. And there are wonderful ways to go, and I really embrace digital at every stage. Like I said, I started with a Black 224, and I carried PCM 60s, PCM 70s, PCM 90s, go on and on, 224 XL, 480, 960, you know, go on and on with my relation. Of course, now it's Percasti, right? There's continuity, but there's always discovery. And so, one of the best days of my mixing life was when my friend Ed Simeon, who was managing, TC USA, called me and said, "You got to come out here and listen to this M5000 reverb." Life changing. Mm-hmm. Absolutely life changing. I still use, M5000 algorithms today. So it's, I was born in the late 40s. I grew up with digital, you know. I was there when the first PCM recorder was introduced, you know. And so it's been something that I was luckily able to assimilate gradually as new stuff came out. We could learn it. And it happened that way with consoles too. You know, when the first Pro 01 or what came out from Yamaha, you know, we all got a chance to get behind it. We even had I can't remember the model number. DMP7 was that it? It was a little 8-banger digital mixer. We had that as our keyboard mixer on the Graceland tour. How cool was that? Right.
Yeah, it's pretty early on.
But me and Andy Forrester, the keyboard tech, said, "Yeah, let's do it. Let's try it." You know, no, we won't have buzzes or hums. Mm-hmm. You know, and which you know, in a mid '80s keyboard rig was rife, right? So it was it ended up being a good choice, and that we ended up moving on from there. You know, looking at the 01 after that, and then I soon incorporated what was the 02 called? Yeah, that became my outboard console. I mean, my sidecar. Mm-hmm. And I would either bring back effects through it, or I would bring I would put like a percussionist on it, so I could turn off mics all the time. You know, I'd have a separate snapshot for every song, and have a little MIDI keypad changer on the main console with me. You know, and just punch a number before every song, and the percussion board would set itself up. You know, I thought that was a wonderful thing. You know, so it was. You know, then that console ended up becoming a DM2000. You know, while I was using a PM5000. You know. So the O2s we had with the 4000s, you know, in that era. Mm-hmm.
So was there a point, you know, early on when you're mixing? I mean, you know, obviously the reference you're trying to go for is, you know, that, you know, people come into the show, they're expecting to kind of hear the album as they remember it. But I imagine the tools afforded to you when you're on the road early on, as opposed to now, you maybe couldn't quite get there. And it was just more about, hey, we just need to recreate what is happening on the stage now. What was that path like? Was there a transition point like, hey, I can actually get to where these albums are now, and that's what the artist actually wants?
I have to admit to being spoiled to a certain degree, because I hit a level of performers and performances that were of the highest caliber very early on in my career. And so I wouldn't say during the A1 years that we were really approaching any sort of great fidelity, but when I went back to the Doobie Brothers to do the 82 farewell tour, when we did it on our PA, when we did it on the Schubert Systems PA, on mixing on Gamble consoles and with all of Dirk's crossover electronics and everything, those shows sounded fabulous. I mean, and we had a wonderful collection of microphones that a studio would have loved to have. No, we went all out for the Doobie Brothers. They were they and Toto were our prime clients. Mm. But we had, like I said, we had very demanding clients at the time with the Starship and the Tubes and Bunny Rate. And these people all got first rate gear. Mm. And people did great shows on these on that stuff. You know, point source nonetheless. Mm-hmm. You know, there were ways of, we became very creative in the ways that we would array the point source boxes, so they would interfere with each other as little as possible. You know, once I learned what a time smear was and things like that, you know, all the stuff that was force fed to me. And but going back to mentors, one of the greatest mentors I had in my career was a gentleman named Mark Gander from JBL, who was in the design and engineering department at JBL Professional. And he and Ken Lopez, who was the national sales manager in the 70s, were responsible for more great PA designs than any two people that were in the country, because they helped everybody build their PAs and how to finance their PAs, you know, and how to make it possible for us to order, you know, 215-inch speakers and pay for them gradually, you know. And so it was that relationship was very, very special. And Mark was my inspiration for actually learning acoustics, learning signal flow, becoming someone. And Mark and I designed a cabinet together that was pretty successful, a cabinet called the Steradian that Schubert System used for years. Hmm. I mean, Mark helped Mark, you know, I'd crunch numbers through Mark and he'd make criticisms, and we ended up, it was the main cabinet for Schubert all the way up into the mid-90s, you know, until Line Arrays came out. And so that was a pretty successful box. And for a guitar player, I was pretty proud of it, you know. And so that, you know, that's mentorship right there. If Mark Gander can get a guitar player and singer to design a PA system, that's pretty damn good.
So, you know, you say you consider yourself a pretty humble person, a pretty quiet person. But if you could be known for one thing from your career, how would you define that? What would you want that to be? Maybe call it legacy. What defines you from your career?
I would hope that people would remember me as someone who made millions of people happy. I really love looking at the faces of people as they're walking out of a show, you know, and I can, once again, that's instantaneous feedback. You don't want to have the people scowling outnumber the people smiling, you know? And luckily it's been pretty, consistent with people walking out with big smiles on their face. And that means so much to me, you know, that I was able to be a clear enough window between them and the artist that they came to admire and to express their love for. And I've been lucky to work for several artists who've allowed me to exercise the control that I can, that I can exert over a show to manipulate people's emotions. And there are so many things you can do with a mix that will lead people in the direction that you want them to take. And to see that be successful and have people walk out of a show with joy radiating from them is the best feedback I can get, and it's all part of the love, and like I said, that's what has sustained me for over 50 years.
I hope you enjoyed the beginning of this journey as we explore the history of live sound together. If you enjoyed this conversation, I would like to ask a few things. First, make sure you subscribe on whatever podcast platform you use. Second, follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Throughout the week, you will see various pictures and stories from the past. Lastly, but most importantly, please tell a friend. Help us get the word out about this project. Please check out and support The Clinic. Their mission is simple. They exist to empower and heal roadies and their families by providing resources and services tailored to the struggles of the touring lifestyle. The Clinic is committed to providing a safe space for roadies and their families to heal while off the road, and to advocate for and empower them to obtain a healthy work environment while on the road. Go to theroadieclinic.com for more info. Do you have a story to tell? Or maybe you want to know more about a specific topic within the history of live sound. You can send me a message on our website, howwegotloud.com. After all, this is a journey for all of us to take together.